Invitations here again. If you want to move up for the talk, you're welcome, or maybe you're happy where you are. I don't know if you noticed on the schedule, but this morning's a little bit different. Or maybe you have the schedule memorized by now. What else is there to read? Sometimes after a few days of retreat, like the bulletin board suddenly get really interesting. Wow. They have service on Sunday here. So anyway, you probably already knew this was going to happen, but in case you didn't, we do the talk a little earlier so we have a little time to sort of transition this morning. Working our way back to whatever the new version of our usual way of being is going to be. Might not be the same as the old version. But first, let me see if I can say a few more things about the various themes of the week, and hopefully one as the speaker has this desire to kind of like tie things up tidily, you know? But life resists tidy conclusions. But nonetheless, we have the convention of giving the last talk, so I'll try to tidy it up. So I really appreciated Uri's talk yesterday on equanimity, and the one before that on compassion. I appreciated what he said, but I also appreciated that he was willing to say anything at all. It's a vulnerable thing, you know, to open your mouth and say anything. In this setting, or really in any setting. And I know every one of us has their version of this in your life. So good on you for opening your mouth, trying to help a little bit, probably causing a little trouble. That's how it goes, you know, with human beings. So if I, and I can maybe extend this, I hope, to Uri and Annie, If we said anything this week that was confusing, or you took in a way that proved harmful to you, we really apologize for that. This does happen. And of course, we do our best, you know, to say things that we believe will be beneficial. But there's so many factors at play there, right? There's what I think I understand and what I think I said, you know, and what the other person thinks they heard, and all that mapped against each of our complex histories and conditioning. In a way, if you think about communication, it's kind of amazing we ever communicate anything at all. You know, that even a rough approximation of what you meant to say is understood by the other person is sort of like a miracle. You know, if you really think about it. But anyway, I don't mean to make light of this. We really are sorry if anything was difficult. And we'd be surprised if there wasn't something like that. You know, sometimes I think I am, like, more or less, like, tapped into whatever the wisdom or the experience of practice has been, or whatever I've received from my teachers. And sometimes there is a sort of a clear sense of how to respond to something that somebody asks or, you know, presents, you know. But other times, I have to admit, I'm more or less shooting from the hip in hopes that I'll say something, you know, that'll be useful, that'll be helpful. Because, you know, consciousness and the heart are really pretty darn vast and mysterious, bigger than we could ever know. And there are definitely plenty of teachers with a ton more experience and insight. Some of them, I understand, you have to like win a lottery to get into the retreat. No joke, I learned this. But actually, there is no such thing as the pure, true, perfect teacher who knows all, you know, about the deep complexity of human experience. When Buddhism first came to the West, America got really excited that that might actually would, and maybe that actually no, there are pure and perfect teachers. They just came from this other tradition we didn't know about before. And so people got really excited, like really excited. And on the one hand, were able to learn a lot in their tremendous enthusiasm and openness to the new teachers bringing this new way of life from Asia, usually. On the other hand, created terribly imbalanced and confused situations in which people were badly hurt. And that continues to unfold to this day. Another major meditation teacher in America, just while we've been sitting here this week, his organization has decided, has committed significant sexual misconduct with students, and the organization is shutting down. So this happens. And that's one of the factors. One, you know, the person who does the misdeeds, of course, is responsible. But that's part of the fault. One part of the fault is this belief, this desire, this reaching for some teacher who can tell us exactly what we need. Someone who knows us better than we know ourselves. So it's wonderful that there are teachers. We need somebody doing this job in this particular way of training. But it's a big problem if we look at it in the wrong way. And we can look at it even more broadly than just looking for human teachers too, I think, as we've all experienced this week, so this helps a lot. We can remember that there are also bird teachers and water teachers and teachers inside our own bodies, a teacher of our heart, the often crazy-making teacher of our own mind. So many teachers. And these many teachers are with us always. And the wonderful thing about a retreat is not that we suddenly have these teachers that we didn't have before, but that we slow down a little and we start to listen. And we hear the teachers around us and within us, the ones that officially signed up for the job and the ones that somehow muscled into the job without our permission. And these teachings are wonderful, but also, of course, these teachings can be challenging to hear. Good teaching is what you need to hear, which is not always the same thing as what you want to hear. And I thought we might also remember on this last morning of our retreat, apparently, that what we learn is not just the kind of learning that we can access with our thinking. There are many other kinds of learning that are happening, have happened, are happening, will happen here. Many kinds of learning that will continue to simmer and cook in us for a long, long time, like the rest of our lives, actually. You know, people go to something and they come back and say, oh, that was just life-changing. Well, that's true. So is every other day of your life. Every day is life-changing. So it's good to not be so too sure you know what happened, you know, here on our retreat. Of course we have our theories, we're all philosophers. But good to remember we don't quite know what happened, to stay curious. And the kind of curiosity that's the curiosity of openness and wonder, like I wonder what happened. A little different from the curiosity that is sort of seeking an answer to a question. So there's a famous bit of a Zen text. I got to get a little bit of formal Zen in, or other, I won't feel complete, so here it is. There's a passage that says, "Do not suppose that what you attain becomes your knowledge and is grasped by your intellect. Although actualized immediately, what is inconceivable may not be apparent. Its emergence is beyond your knowledge." That's pretty clear, huh? Do not suppose that what you attain becomes your knowledge and is grasped by your intellect. Although actualized immediately, that which is inconceivable may not be apparent. Its emergence is beyond your knowledge. So these words were written in the early 11th century. And doesn't it sound like really, I mean, the wording's a little unusual, but pretty contemporary sounding. Of course, it wasn't written in English, so that's part of why it sounds contemporary. It's translated from Japanese. Although actualized immediately, what is inconceivable may not be apparent. So inconceivable sounds very lofty and philosophical. But actually, I think in a way, inconceivable is quite simple. It's those vast areas of life that can't be conceived of. And how do we conceive? We conceive with concepts and ideas and words. So much of life can't be handily turned into words and ideas and categories if we pay attention. I think we know this is true. I appreciate Uri saying that it's really hard to talk about the fourth of those divine abodes, equanimity, because maybe whatever equanimity actually is something that can't really be quite nailed down with words and concepts. Because words and concepts are a bit rigid. Once you say it's this, it's hard for your mind to allow in the possibility that it's also that, or that, or that. So what is inconceivable is some of what we were studying this week. We were studying the inconceivable. Although actualized immediately, he says. So that's interesting. Whatever you learn this week is not something that you'll gradually figure out. It's already here. It's in you. And that you can trust it. This is a really important point. Often at the last, end of a retreat, or like especially like the longer the retreat, the higher the stakes, it seems like to our certain mind, at the end we're like, how do I hold on to this? How do I remember this? Will they really send the poems? Well, we'll do our best. But beyond the poems, right? Those flashes of whatever. If they say flashes of insight, then someone will say, wait a minute, I didn't get any flashes of insight. Now I'm really upset. Whatever it was, we want to hold on to it. We want to grasp it in a certain way. Why? Because we think we don't have it. So this is a trust practice. We don't use the word faith a lot in the sort of secular mindfulness movement, but actually, to be honest, it's actually a faith practice. Don't tell anybody. We'll lose our charter. But the faith is maybe not, faith in some other, but faith in this mystery of the inconceivable and the understanding of the inconceivable, which is a different kind of understanding. Because, he says, its emergence is beyond your knowledge. Realizing that the deep forces of healing and growth, healing and growth and liberation aren't in that knowledge kind of realm. But it's not that they don't emerge. It's not that they don't exist, whatever this learning is. It's real enough, but it's a different quality of reality, since we tend to conceive of reality as only that which we can pin down with concepts. The bigger reality, maybe. But it does emerge. It's here. Maybe it's just hanging out a little bit outside of the little circle of light that our intellect and conscious awareness can shine in the darkness. It's It's a comforting circle, and we like it very much. We work hard to expand it. The problem is, have you ever thought about this? The problem with knowledge is, like, if you conceive of knowledge as a circle, right? So the circle gets bigger, that's wonderful. But what else gets bigger? The edges, the not knowing part gets bigger too, right? So the more you know, the more you know you don't know. But good thing we're listening to these teachings and we can be happy about that. That's great. More inconceivable is out there. So anyway, I thought that was a helpful little expression. This is from Zen Master Ehe Dogen. It's a Japanese priest who is credited with bringing one of the branches of Zen Buddhism from China to Japan in the 11th century. So there's definitely some mystery to this enterprise. And there are also these practical teachings that we've been trying to work with and, you know, maybe get a little confused by. Pretty much, what we tried to say all week boils down to something like, practice kindness, see if you can turn towards suffering and meet it with compassion, delight in the joys of all beings, and keep your feet on the ground. So that's what we're trying to say. It just took us like almost 5 hours to try to say it. Practice kindness, see if you can turn towards suffering and meet it with compassion. Delight in the joys of others, the goodness of others, and keep your feet on the ground. So let's do just one last practical teaching, which seems apropos of going back out into the world, which we never left, but we have that idea, going back out into the world. This is the teaching of the 8 worldly winds. And the goal here is not to be blown over or blown around quite so easily by these 8 worldly winds. The 8 worldly winds that knock you off your feet are given in 4 pairs. Here they are. And by the way, in addition to sending you the poems, we'll also post the talks. So you can read this later if you want, or listen to it later. We can be company on your commute, you know? Anyway, the 8 worldly winds. Gain and loss, fame and infamy, praise and blame, joy and sorrow. Gain and loss, fame and infamy, praise and blame, joy and sorrow. The suggestion here is that we could actually unhook our happiness, our deeply rooted possibility of being okay, unhook that from getting the half of these pairs, the halves of these pairs that we like, unhook it from avoiding the halves of these pairs we don't like. So let me just comment on each pair briefly. Gain and loss. So we want to gain, we don't want to lose. And yet life is a continuous flow of gain and loss, loss and gain. Stuff, health, friends, careers, all these are gained and lost in a tapestry or like a kaleidoscope that seems to be our life. And life itself is one big gain and loss. My Zen teacher used to say sometimes, do you know what the most consistently terminal condition is? Birth. Right? Birth is a terminal condition. We gain this embodied life, and that means we will lose this embodied life. Gain and loss. So they go together, you know? Well, we can start a little smaller than that. Noticing when we want to gain something, when we have some fear about losing something, and turning towards that, right? So just like we've been saying, awareness, mindfulness, common humanity, you know, we're not the only ones hooked on this one. And kindness. Oh, it's tricky being someone who always wants to gain and never wants to lose because it's just a rigged game from the beginning, right? It's not going to work out. Nothing wrong with desiring wonderful things that we might gain. Desiring a wonderful friendship or some new useful tool for your work. Nothing wrong with this. But it's the hook, the hookedness that's the problem, isn't it? We already talked about this as desire being okay, but the clinging to it being the problem. But the challenge is, of course, that they're not so separate in our consciousness, mixed in various degrees to our desire for gain and our fear of loss is that clinging. So we practice with that. Practice with that, little by little. 10% happier. 10% less clingy, gain desire. You know? Repeat. Fame and infamy is the second pair. We have gain and loss, then there's fame and infamy. So I use this as an example, as sort of fuel for the third Brahma-vihara. Remember about mudita, empathetic joy, taking joy in the happiness and success of others. The practice of freedom from jealousy of those with fame, you know. But also freedom from letting go of maneuvering to get more fame ourselves. And fame sounds a little big and lofty, like, I don't want to be famous, you know. I just want all my colleagues and clients to love me, that's all. You know? Right. Just a little fame, you know, small F fame. Everyone in my family to appreciate me in a certain way. And fame does happen, I suppose. People may choose to pay more attention to you out of whatever need they have for that. Fame seems to be very bound up in the different roles we play. You know, the person, the super famous people, it's not really Madonna that's famous, right? I don't even know what her original name was, you know. It's the role that she's developed and we've all helped her create. I saw Madonna on the street one time in New York. So cool. Yeah. So happy. She's surrounded by people. I suppose they were her people, probably. Anyway. You may never be Madonna, but people may get interested in you. And that's okay. We can accept that and we can appreciate their kind attention and appreciate their belief that we've been important to them in their lives in some way. But it's also helpful to remember that it's not exactly you that they're excited about. It's in some way the reflection of you that's in them. That your efforts and however you somehow ended up, which is not exactly your fault, right? This rich combination of factors and things that brought you forth, somehow you ended up in the right shape and appearance and configuration to remind someone else of their own goodness, to remind someone else of their own strength and wisdom. So when someone tells you you're amazing, whatever you are, therapist, teacher, friend, social worker, it's good to actually appreciate that, I think. It's a little small-minded to try to dodge the compliment. Someone very kindly, just yesterday or so, took me to task for that. they were appreciating something about something I did, and I tried to dodge the compliment. And she very kindly said, "No, I want you to hear this." Oh, thank you. So that's a little ungrateful, you know, to try to dodge that energy. It's okay, because it is you who did that, who is that, and it also isn't you. So I try to express my appreciation back, not just for the compliment, but also for somehow this positive connection, this life-affirming thing has happened between us that we both contributed to. But it's also really important to remember that it's not exactly me, it's not exactly you that the person is grateful for. And that it's an example of a wondrous thing in human beings, the way we need each other. Because we really do. And sometimes we feel that and see that in a way that's really beautiful. And we're human beings, of course, it's mixed up too, you know. But the suffering comes, of course, from seeking fame, seeking approval, right? Seeking validation and hooking that to our happiness. So these are a little tricky, right? Because these are, as we said at the beginning, these kind of high bar Buddhist teachings of complete freedom. And they're sort of like the ultimate that they're trying to describe, and then the kind of provisional fluidity of reality. So there's nothing wrong with asking for approval, you know, asking for validation. I would just suggest do it straight up, you know. I have done this, in fact, in classes, you know, or whenever I'm presenting or something and I'm feeling a little uncertain about it. You can do this, try this. I've actually said to groups of people that I barely knew, "I'm feeling a little uncertain right now and I could use a little reassurance. Is this going okay?" You know, you're risking that they might say no, you know.